schematic of that amplifier. You can get it on boat anchors and see how they did it. You'll understand a good input of how to understand automatic antenna tuners. But like I say, if you want to see how to homebrew a version of it, look in May 2005 QST. Go ahead, Dick.
Very good information. Okay, we've got both Alex and Wesley in that order making a comment. N2NNU, go right ahead, Alex, K2RIW. Did you get that, Dick? No, I didn't, Alex. Would you say it again? I'm now hearing you when you said, yeah, I get that, Dick. There is a DS5W2 or something on frequency tries to get in.
I'm sorry, DS5WXQ.
It sounds like DX5WXQ. Your audio is very low, but go right ahead and tell us your name, and do you have a comment on the subject that's on the floor, so to speak. Over to you, sir. My name is Dick. I'm K2RIW.
How you doing, Dick? This is actually DX5WRQ, portable. No, I'm sorry, I can't say anything on what you guys are talking about. This is John, and I'm just checking out a portable unit I picked up for a kid.
Okay, John. Your portable unit is sounding quite good. Audio is a tiny bit low, but it's working very well. Wesley, go ahead with your comment. Into XJN, K2RIW. Wait for the beep.
All right, comment.
Okay, Alex, go right ahead with your comment.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I just, in between, I heard that other station, DXW2. I don't understand that code for anyhow. Well, the fact that we're talking about an automatic tuner indicates that Wesley is thinking actually about HF frequencies and not VHF, EHF, whatever high frequency stuff. I haven't seen yet an automatic tuner for frequencies above 60 megahertz, 50 megahertz. So I inferred that he is talking about HF. Because of that, I thought that the description that you gave for a directional coupler is a little bit misleading, because at HF frequencies, the directional coupler looks quite different from what you have discussed. So Wesley might not be able to identify it as fast as we would like to. So perhaps you want to go back and verify what I'm saying here. Also, the directional couplers are very, very frequency dependent. It's very seldom that you can find a frequency directional coupler that spans more than 2 or 3 octaves. So this is why we have multiple bands into the
repeater. Time out.
Very fine. Alex, you timed out the machine. The machine times out very rapidly these days, but I got the gist of what you're saying. I'm going to redress it. The amount of information and misinformation on directional couplers is huge. Everybody thinks a directional coupler is a very magic circuit that has a very narrow frequency of operation, because they read the label, and the label on the package says that. That label is misleading. I'm going to give you the best example I can think of. When I was building my amplifier triple or strip line circuit, that's in the February 1970 issue of Ham Radio Magazine, and it's on the front cover, way back in the dark ages. This was a strip line circuit that puts out something like 300 watts on 2 meters and something like 70 watts on 432, all in one circuit. Strip line circuit, and the strip line circuit is fed by a 4CX 250B tube. So it's a high power strip line circuit And depending on how you set the two resonators in the plate circuit, if you resonate the 2-meter circuit, you're putting out 2-meter energy. Resonate the 432 circuit, it operates as a tripler. You change the bias in the drive a little bit, and the tripled output of 432 comes out. When I wanted to publish that article, when I wanted to publish that article in Ham Radio Magazine, the editor, Jim Fisk, said, how do I know what other frequencies are coming out? Well, what I needed was a way of sampling the frequencies coming out into a spectrum analyzer. But every spectrum analyzer in those days could not tolerate more than 1 watt of input. And my circuit can produce 300 watts on 2 meters and 70 watts on 432. So I needed some way to cut down the power in a calibrated manner and still see what frequencies are present. I wanted a 30 dB directional coupler that operated at those frequencies. And I went to the stock room and they said, never heard of it. Don't know what you're talking about. And the directional couplers they've got can't tolerate more than 10 watts. Well, I looked real hard at what they've got, and I realized that if I take a directional coupler that's designed for 10,000 megacycles and recalibrate it down at 432 and 144 megacycles, I would know what's going on. The best-kept secret in the world is that a directional coupler, no matter what frequency is designed for, if it has a high-quality terminating resistor inside, if it has a high-quality terminating resistor inside, the directional coupler gives you a calibrated amount of coupling at the design frequency. The coupler I picked up was designed for 10 decibels of coupling coefficient at 10,000 megacycles. That directional coupler works all the way down to DC, and I'm not kidding. The only thing wrong is that the response starts falling off at 6 dB per octave. The directional coupler gives you the maximum coupling coefficient when the parallel line is a quarter wavelength long at the operating frequency. There's nothing wrong with making the parallel line not a quarter wavelength long, an eighth wavelength long, a 16th wavelength long, a 50th of a wavelength long. That's exactly what you're doing with your Bird watt meter. The Bird watt meter is a directional coupler. The coupled portion of it, the parallel line that's inside of that slug, is much shorter than a quarter wavelength. Therefore, it's not flat in frequency. It falls off 6 dB per octave as you go down, or you could say it rises 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. Your next question is going to be, how did they make the Bird watt meter slug flat in frequency? And why does it have a limited frequency region? Well, what they did is to put a RC network beyond the directional coupler and that on
repeater. Time out.
I know all of this, Dick. That RC network has a roll-off in the opposite direction of 6 dB per octave. Therefore, even though the directional coupler is being used at a much lower frequency than its design, where ordinarily a directional coupler is flat at a quarter wavelength of parallel line, you could make that parallel line much, much shorter, and you end up with a much higher coupling coefficient in decibels. Instead of it being a 10 dB coupler, it becomes a 15, a 20, a 30. So by using the 10 gigahertz directional coupler way down at 144 megacycles, instead of it being a 10 dB coupler, it became a 35 dB coupler. The way it falls off in frequency is something you can exactly calibrate. It's got a very simple formula, and you can go back and recheck it with instrumentation to be sure. So a directional coupler goes all the way down to DC in a predictable manner, if you're smart enough. So making a directional coupler work outside of its design frequency range, as long as you're going lower, it falls off also again as you go higher in frequency, but it loses directivity. Only at the design frequency of a quarter wavelength long and less than a quarter wavelength long on the parallel portion of it will it maintain its directivity. So that's an extremely well-kept secret, the fact that a directional
repeater. Time out.
It's a very well-kept secret that a directional coupler can be used far outside of its frequency range as long as you know what you're doing. And the way it falls off, it follows a formula of a sine wave where instead of the argument of the sine, the trigonometric function being phase angle, it is frequency. You could say that the directional coupler at its design frequency is a quarter wavelength long. You could say it's got 90 degrees of length inside. The sine of 90 degrees is 1. That's where your directional coupler gives your calibrated coupling, like 10 dB. If I go to half the frequency, where now my parallel line is only 45 degrees long, I take the sine of 45, 0.707, that's an extra 3 dB down. That really means that at half the frequency, my directional of the design, if the design was 10 gigs and I'm operating at 5 gigs, by that formula, it'll have not 10 dB of directional coupling, it'll have 13 dB of coupling. Let's see if I got that right. 0.707, I think it's correct. 707 is an extra 3 dB down. And by that sine function, you can calculate exactly what it's going to do, and because of the slight perturbations of that 50 ohm term
repeater, timeout.
Because of the exact perturbations. In other words, the 50 ohm termination inside might be a little bit away from 50 ohms, and there are ways of making a directional coupler much more broad, and that is the parallel line is not just purely parallel to the straight through line. It's got a number of steps to it. And so Hewlett-Packard does have a directional coupler which operates from 0.5 to 18 gigahertz by way of a whole bunch of steps. With that directional coupler, this simple formula of mine would be not quite accurate. However, even that stepped directional coupler, as you go lower than the design frequency, it falls off in a very characteristic manner, which is easy to calibrate, and it keeps its directivity. You can easily find out how much signal is flowing from left to right versus how much signal is flowing from right to left when it goes through your directional coupler. A very handy device if you know how to use it. I wonder how many people have heard of that characteristic before about a directional coupler. I think it was Wesley, it was Alex that first, I'm going to go to Alex and Wesley in that order. I think it was Alex that you just brought that to our attention. N2NNU, KQRIW in the TechNet.
May dictate KY.
Bell recognized, but Alex first. Wait for the beep, Alex.
Okay, Dick. If I promise to recognize that you are the king, would you please promise not to be so long-winded? You're preaching to the choir here. Don't forget, most of us know what you're talking about. Oh, God. You almost put me to sleep here. Now then, I don't know why you're talking about the most kept, secret. Everybody knows that. I don't know where you're coming from. Anyhow, let me drop it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you think everyone knows it. Whenever I've given that talk in the past, Mel and I get a whole lot of emails saying, why in the world hasn't someone told me that before? Why is it not in any of the textbooks I have ever read? You lead a charmed life, Alex. You have heard it, and you're bored with it. The rest of this audience, a high percentage of the people, have never heard it. That long-winded discussion was for their benefit. I wasn't intended to preach to you, but yes, as usual, I'm long-winded. You've got it, Alex.
Yes, Dick, this is why we have emails, so if anybody wants more information, he can write you, and I'm sure you're going to answer.
Come back at me with your call sign. I'm trying to log you guys in.
Want to double with anybody here? Is anybody else on frequency? Okay. I will take issue with the fact that you are saying that a directional coupler can be made to function on any frequency you want. That is simply not true. It's physically impossible. Okay? What you are talking, you're talking about two different systems put together and then named, as usual, a directional coupler. First it is the directional coupler and then it's the correction circuit. We were talking about only the directional coupler. Then it comes the correction circuitry that actually corrects for all the problems that are occurring in the directional coupler. Let me drop it a little bit so we'll not time out again.
What makes you say that we can't talk about the directional coupler all by itself once you know the way it behaves versus frequency? When you go down in frequency, why can't I use that all the way down to DC all by itself? What makes you say I can't do that, Alex? Over to you, Alex, with the delay.
You can, but your indication now are meaningless. You need the correction circuitry. Okay? Let's put the correction circuitry aside. We want a directional coupler that indicates its natural state without any other circuitry around it. That can be done on a single frequency. That's all. It's physically impossible to do it in a different way. Sorry for that, Dick.
Okay, you're expressing a strongly felt opinion, and I know where you're coming from. I disagree. A smart person knows that the directional coupler barefoot, all by itself, is not going to be flat when he goes down in frequency, but it falls off in a controlled manner, 6 dB per octave, a predictable, deterministic manner, and a smart person knows it keeps its directivity, and he knows if he's using it at one quarter of the design frequency, it has 6 decibels of more coupling coefficient. If it used to be 10 dB, it's now a 16 dB. A smart person can use that into a, say for instance, a spectrum analyzer, and he can recalibrate everything he reads off that screen. He can readjust, he can normalize, if he's got enough smarts. Why can't he do that, Alex? N2NNU, K2RIW?
Again, you are describing two systems under a single name, and this is not fair, okay? When you're starting to make correction to the indication of your meter, then you're talking about the correction circuitry and the directional coupler. The directional coupler is a self-standing unit. It will give you backwards and forward information for a single frequency. It will give you correctly the information for a single frequency. Once you're getting off this frequency, you're in the never-never land. You have to add this circuitry that you're talking about, that we have to be smart about it. Okay? So, what I'm saying, Dick, let's not mix eggs and chickens. Okay? The eggs are the directional couplers. The chickens are the correction circuitry or our mind that we add or whatever, 3 dB, 6 dB per octave. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay, I'm going to partially agree with you. If I want to have very simple instrumentation where I simply look at the Dawson valve movement, I look at the meter, and I know what's going on, irrespective of frequency, yes, it takes a dual circuit, a directional coupler plus a correction circuit. However, if I don't have the correction circuit and I've got the raw directional coupler with a detector going into that meter and I know what frequency I have put into that directional coupler, I have selected the band switch on my transmitter, I know where I set the VFO dial, I know what frequency I'm on. If I know I'm on one quarter of the design frequency for the coupler, I know that it was designed at a particular frequency, it had 10 dB of coupling. Everything I read off that meter is 10 dB down from reality. If I go to one quarter of the frequency, everything I read off that meter is 16 dB down. You and I are smart enough to use that. I don't have to put the correction circuit. The correction circuit can be in between the ears of the observer. It's in the brain. That's where the correction circuit can happen. You and I are smart enough to do that. Over to you, Alex. K2RIW. Wait for the beep.
But you still use the correction circuit. even if it is a gray matter into your brain. It is a correction circuit, no matter what you're telling me. It's a table, you know how it uses. What I'm saying, realize that a purely physical instrument has a physical representation that is not possible to be made to function correctly without the correction. Okay? You have to have the correction somewhere, be it in the, between your ears or somewhere under your table. That's what I'm trying to say, Dick, sir.
Okay, I'm going to pick up with Wesley and Mel also. We got a lot of people back up here on this particular one. Everything we ever use, Alex, there are times when I use it out of the design frequency region. A simple bandpass filter has a certain low frequency, center frequency, and high frequency where it gives a predicted performance. If I go outside of that frequency range, I'm down into the skirt selectivity, the rejection of the filter. I know where the filter is going to reject. That's not the frequency it was designed for. I can use it there. The directional coupler, it falls off in a deterministic manner, a predictable manner. I'm smart enough to use it there. You don't want to use it there. That's your choice. I often use them at a place where I have to use the gray matter to do the correction. I'm not adding another circuit. Yes, the circuit is in the gray matter. To me, that is perfectly legal. Mel was the first person who wanted to comment on this, and then Alex in that order. Wesley. K2KEY. K2RAW. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, I'll give you the very simple answer to all this. That's why I use what is known as a return loss bridge, an RLB. Been around a long time. I know I've gone through this, and Dick, I think we gave a really detailed explanation of how an RL, a return loss bridge, which is a type of directional coupler, works. And as far as emails, let me specify, the emails are complimentary that we do go into great detail on how things work. And if we, in fact, I carry it over to the morning next on 10 meters today and got very detailed questions. And they appreciate, people tell me, even on the 10-meter net, they appreciate, as they say, the long-winded, so-called, explanation. But getting back to return loss bridge, I have used a return loss bridge and have very much success in measuring strictly in dB, because now I can convert dB to volts on my meter, or I can go the other way around. I can also factor in, for instance, if I had a 1.5 SWR, which would be 14 dB return loss, and my feed line had a 1 dB return loss, well, I multiply that by 2, so times 1 plus the 14, I know I have a 16 dB, or would convert to an SWR of 16 dB, would convert to an SWR of around 1.35 to 1. So working with that, that's the easiest way. It is a directional coupler, an RLB bridge, Dick, over.
I agree with you, Mel. Many of the things we use are less than ideal. My transmission line has more insertion loss at a higher frequency than a lower frequency. Therefore, if I want to know the standing wave ratio of the antenna, and I measure reflected voltage in the shack, or I measure apparent standing wave ratio in the shack, I have to use a calibration chart for my transmission line to know what is the true standing wave ratio of the antenna. Alex will call that an extra circuit. I call it proper use of the gray matter. Many, many things that we use outside of the frequency range. A smart amateur is an adaptable person. He thinks out of the box. A circuit is not going to explode and catch on fire simply because you use it outside of the design frequency region. you can recalibrate what it does and know what it indicates. Alex says he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to do it without adding an extra circuit. That's his choice. I'm willing to be a little bit more adaptable. You make a decision as to which way you want to go. Not all of the circuits I've got are perfect, where the meter I can use directly at all frequencies I care about. I don't spend the money to buy that kind of circuitry. I use things that are less than ideal, and I can...
Repeater, time out.
I use things that are less than ideal, and I readjust and calibrate. I use the gray matter to use them outside of the frequency region. For me, it works. Alex doesn't want to go there. That's his choice. Wesley's got a comment on all this. N2XJN, K2RIW.
When you make a directional coupler, would you sell it? Would you say to your customer that you have to use your gray matter to understand what the meter is saying? That's what I'm driving at. An instrument has to be readable at the first glance without any conversions or whatever. This is why those are bench instruments. Anyhow, sorry for that. Leslie, sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, there's another way of looking at this one, Alex. Very, very few do it, but there are some manufacturers of directional couplers that will give you the full curve. They will show you how fast it falls off at lower frequencies. They will print that curve on the front cover. Would you then be willing to use that directional coupler where the extra curve has been provided for you by the manufacturer? I'm willing to build that curve myself. But if the manufacturer supplied that curve for you, would you then be willing to use it outside of its center frequency region? Over to you, Alex.
Oh, certainly. There's no discussion, because this is the conversion tool that we're talking about. That little label on top of it is the conversion tool. You don't seem to understand the inversion, the difference here, Dick. It's too real.
Whether the manufacturer supplies that conversion curve or whether I derive it myself because the manufacturer didn't do it for me, it doesn't matter. As long as I've done it in a calibrated manner, traceable to the Bureau, which is accurate enough for me, I will admit that if I was running a business, if the Alex and Richard business was selling equipment measured with this kind of instrumentation, where you're using it outside of the frequency range of where the manufacturer has supplied the calibration curve, I'll admit I can't do that. I'll admit that most of the customers will say, you're using it outside of the calibration range, I don't trust it. That I understand. But when it comes to my amateur use of the equipment, it doesn't have to be that exacting. It's good enough for me. I can run that curve myself, and I believe it. And after that, the data is good enough for me, even though I can't sell the equipment that I've tested that way. I know that Wesley wanted to make a comment, and then Rich in that order. N2XJN, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
K-E-2-J.
Okay, point of order. Go ahead, Eric. And we're learning that the beeps always start the same. If we wait through a couple of them, the machine sort of resets itself. Over to you, Alex. Eric.
Wesley.
All right, I've been running a little... I'm going to stop you guys for a minute. I've been running a little sociology experiment. I've been changing the time length on you just to see what would happen. And I think the ultimate answer to the problem is because people jump so much into it, I'm actually going to program the thing so that when the last drop happens, okay, I'm going to program it so there's going to be a two-second space in which, like, if somebody drops their call sign in, and right now, by the way, the time is set for 90 seconds. And you've killed the IRLP several times, even with this short timeout, because the IRLP requires 2 seconds to recycle. If you listen to 375 and you drop it, it's more than 2 seconds later that you hear the beep on the Selden side. And that you have to also compensate for the delay. Let me drop it for a second. Okay, and the reason why I made this ridiculous tone is to try and force you guys into waiting the 2 damn seconds, because you don't. Okay, No, I think the ultimate solution is going to be this. All right? Dick says something. Somebody jumps in and gives their call. It's going to go back to Dick. Dick is going to acknowledge them, and then you're supposed to wait for the beep. So, since that doesn't happen, what I think I'm going to do, which will solve the problem of blowing everybody off, because we had 7 stations logged into it. They're all gone now, okay? People are interested in listening to this, but we constantly blow them away, and they don't want to redial. I don't blame them. So, the solution is going to be, there's going to be 2 seconds after the first carrier drop. The timer is going to kick in, and it's going to mute the receiver, which will then force 2 seconds of blank space. So now you guys can jump on top of one another, and eventually you're going to time out the local repeater, but you're not going to time out the IOLP. What do you think about that, Dick?
Yeah, I sort of understand where you're coming from, Eric. As you can tell, we get hot and heavy. We get emotionally involved in our opinions on the subjects of discussion, which have rarely been discussed to this level before. We get overly excited. We jump on top of each other. We're timing out the machine. And I guess we've got to slowly convince ourselves to take a deep breath, back off a little bit. This is not life and death. This is only ham radio. This is a hobby. It's not our occupation, per se. We've got to get a little bit less emotional. You're right, Eric. Back to you, Eric. And so I think what you're going to do is change the timing in such a way that if we don't wait the 2 seconds, we will be timing out this machine before the other, and therefore we'll have to wait for a reset because we'll have no choice. I think that's what you're about to do. KE2EJ for a comment. K2RIW.
What, Eric?
This is VX5WRQ. New York, I actually had a question for one of you guys.
Alright. Really, if you want to be, because this is really a sociology experiment, guys, alright? It's all about your own behavior. Think about it. You've got the station in Las Vegas. We had a station in California. We had a station in Florida. We have the guy who comes in this way who dials up through his own link in Bayshore. And occasionally we have some folks from Florida, and I've seen folks from other places that like to listen to this net. Okay? You guys are being completely discourteous to all these other people. You know, we put it there so that they can enjoy and listen and learn. And basically we're telling them to go to hell. So, what is going to happen is I'm going to develop a program which basically mutes the receiver. So you can talk until your face is blue, and nobody's going to hear you. So I think that's ultimately going to be the solution. And what it does is it gives courtesy to the other folks that are joining us. Back to you, Dick.
This is VX5WRQ with the question.
Very fine, John. We got you on the list right after Wesley and possibly Alex. These two guys have been waiting to make a comment, and then I'm going to come back to you, John. N2XJN, Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet. You better wait 2 seconds or we're going to get hollered at.
Okay, November to X-ray, Juliet, November. And that's what I thought. When I was thinking about the questions for today's snatch, I was thinking about something that is going to attract your emotion, and that's what I thought is going to happened. Now, I'm kind of backing up Dick, even though I see that Alex is right, but not into the complete sense. If you take a look at directional couple made by Johnson, Johnson was not in the Viking yet. That they joined, well, actually, yeah, he started at that time. Then there was the Johnson Viking, and the coupler was 250-37. That coupler, actually, you forgot to say that some of the things that are very, very important to the couplers is the resistance, which is mostly 52 ohms, and the power that this thing is going to handle. Because there are some of them that they could handle only 2 watts, but there are some of them they can handle 100 watts. Let me drop for a moment. Okay, and then, this small cylinder was actually the part of the Viking Johnson Viking meter, the antenna analyzer. And that's what I said at the beginning of, that it's creating the this device is actually creating the PL network for antenna analyzer or tuner. Now, that's one part of this. Now, as far as when I was asking about the difference between the bridge and the directional coupler, let me drop for a moment, I'm afraid. Okay. The gentleman who said about the Collins circuitry, well, I'm not sure who copied whom. Was it Whiteson? Because Dick said about the Whiteson. But actually, who copied whom? The Whiteson is the circuitry, it's the basic circuitry. And then there is a third guy who actually uses the phase compensated bridges, which is the Bruni. And my question to Dick is, if you can, he can say something about the difference between these principles of the workings, of the working of the device. Back to you.
I think about the best answer I can give to your question, Wesley, is that when it comes to sensing circuits that sense whether or not you have a known impedance or an unknown impedance, these bridge-like networks, the Wheatstone bridge is the one that people learn about very early in electrical engineering, probably in the junior year in colleges in the United States. But there's a large number of circuits like that. Some of them don't have only resistors on the four legs. They have various combinations of inductors, capacitors, resistors, variable devices, and whatever. And they each have their advantages and disadvantages for a particular circuit. Now, whether you use a directional coupler, and by the way, you can make an extremely simple directional coupler by taking a piece of enameled wire and snaking it under the braid on the outside of a piece of coaxial cable. And when you set up the right resistors and detector diodes on the outside of that, where the piece of enameled wire, which lies parallel inside of your piece of RGAU, you can set up a very convenient standing wave ratio bridge. And some of the Radio Amateurs Handbook articles and the antenna book show you how to do that. There's a large number, let me drop. There's a large number of various bridge circuits that can measure impedance, measure reflected power, various ways of calibrating them. In all cases, what's happening with a transmission line, the thing that we really care about, is we would like every one of those 100 watts coming out of the transmitter to go down that transmission line once, go on to the antenna, be radiated into space, and peg somebody's signal strength meter a zillion miles away. That's what we'd like. But the characteristic impedance of a transmission line is such that it's got this crazy characteristic that if you don't put exactly 50 ohms of resistance as a load on that transmission line, it's going to reflect some of your power from the antenna connection back down that line. And when you measure the amount of power that's reflected, it tells you exactly what's going on if you're smart enough. And these various directional couplers and bridge networks will measure for you the amount of reflected power. That's what you really want to know. And you want to minimize it. And if you can make that reflected power go to zero, most of the time your circuit is working as your antenna network is working as best it can. There's a large number of bridges. There's a large number of directional coupler-like devices. We haven't even gotten into the Lang coupler, which is another
repeater. Time out.
This is VX5WRQ.
You're on the list, John. Alex wanted to make a comment on this, and then I'm going to go over to John. N2NNU, Alex, K2RIW.
Thanks. Okay, let that drop for a second.
mistake also that power rating for the directional couplers are meant, well, not meant, are set for no SWR. Once you're getting an SWR reading, then power ratings are off scale. You don't know what you what your power rating of the machine is. The same with antenna tuners. Antenna tuners power ratings are for a good tune-up, for the time that everything is up resonance. Once you're getting off resonance, the power tuner, the automatic tuner, or the manual tuner, whatever, power rating must be derated very, very high. Back to you, Dick. Let's not forget I had that announcement whenever you're ready.
Dick, before you do that, before you switch to another person, I just have two very short, smiling questions for you.
I think it was Eric that said my name. Go ahead, Eric. I guess that wasn't Eric. And John has been waiting very patiently. John, give us a few words. DX5WRQ, K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. Wait for me.
Forgot about me and 2EO.
Sorry. Go ahead, John.
How you doing, Dick, and Alex, and everybody else out there, BX5WRQ. Yeah, I know, no, very interesting conversation. Unfortunately, I wish you could add more to it. I actually have a question. If one of you guys could just help me out, it's been a while. Hold on, let me break. I actually picked up a gift for somebody who is going to be transmitting very soon and taking the test tomorrow. It's a Yaesu FT-270R, which I'm transmitting off of right now. I just want to know, how's the overall sound quality and everything, because they wanted to steer towards a portable rather than a mobile unit.
Very fine, John. That FT-270R, sounding excellent. Don't change it. It's working like a charm. And so they should be very happy with that gift that you got for them. Rich, N2EO, wait for the beep, and go ahead with your comment.
Little scratchy, S-Y-L.
Okay, Dick, M2EO. By the way, that VX5 station sounds good. I think Victor X-Ray 5 is Canada. I believe that's a Canadian call, not Delta X-Ray. I believe it's Victor X-Ray, Dick. Dick, I got a question for you on the subject of directional couplers. I'm glad you brought it up. There's a chart in the book that comes with the Bird 43 two-line watt meter doing just what you say, interpolating using Bird elements that are out of the range. Trouble is I can't find the book. It's been a long time since I bought that meter, probably 25 years ago. I'm going to be tuning up a 6-meter rig. This be 110 AE. 50 megacycle sideband rig. I have slugs, 250 watt slug that covers 2 to 30 megahertz. We're going to be approximately 1 octave above 30 megahertz. Do you happen to know how many dBs down it's going to be? Is it 3 dB per octave or 1 dB?
Don, good question, Rich, and I don't know. If it was a pure, short directional coupler, in other words, the raw element that's doing the sampling in the slug of the Bird watt meter, I could give you a 5% accuracy or inaccuracy prediction. Because they've added an extra circuit to take the normal 6 dB per octave of roll-up in sensitivity versus frequency, and they've added an extra circuit that tries to roll down at 6 dB per octave to correct for that, so that across its calibrated frequency range, it is essentially flat. Because of that circuit, I can't make that prediction for you. However, you've got the right kind of instrumentation where you can make the measurement. But now let me get to and a subject that Alex just mentioned. Can we drop? Many people believe that a directional coupler cannot be used beyond a certain power level. That's extremely true. If your directional coupler is rated for, let me pick a number, 144 megacycles, and it's rated for 100 watts maximum, and you use it with more than 100 watts going through it, there's a good probability you're going to create damage. There are people who believe that it will only be damaged if the standing wave ratio is high. Not true. The way the directional coupler works is that for the signal flowing forward, when you're using the directional coupler in such a direction that it's only measuring reflected power, let me drop.
That was working, who said that?
That when it's, I've got it set in such a way that it's only measuring reflected power. That parallel path that's inside the directional coupler, the parallel path itself picks up forward signal and reverse signal with equal coupling coefficient. However, because there is a 50 ohm termination on one side of that parallel line, the internal coupling line, your forward power goes into the 50 ohm termination and you don't see it. The reverse power comes out of the port that you are sampling and now you see it. So you think that the directional coupler, as long as the standing wave ratio is low, you can tolerate higher power. Absolutely not. You're still going to burn up that 50 ohm termination inside. Each one of those directional couplers has a power limit because of the straight through line is a piece of strip line that can only tolerate a certain amount of power before the printed board it's on will overheat. And the termination inside has a certain limitation. However, if you take that directional coupler to a much lower frequency where the parallel line is not picking up 10 dB down, but it's picking up 25 dB down, you can now go, in that example,
repeater, timeout.
You can now go 15 dB higher in power. Because in most cases, the thing that gives you the first limitation on power of a directional coupler is how much power the termination can tolerate. Quite often the straight through line, if it's built in air as a wide piece of brass inside of, say for instance, a Nauter brand of directional coupler, the coupler may be rated for 10 watts maximum. I have put 1,000 watts through one of those, as long as I'm doing it on a low enough frequency where it has a 25 or 30 dB directional the coupling coefficient. So, as long as you know what you're doing, you can get away with some of these things. That's part of what I'm saying. But let me give you one other example of where people get in trouble. Let me drop. Quite often a person is trying to make a precise measurement of reflected power. And he's really tuned his moon bounce antenna as best he can. He thinks he's got a 1.01 standing wave ratio. Well, when he's got a 1.01 standing wave ratio, the forward power is 1,000 watts. The reverse power might be 1 watt. But if he's using the 1,000 watt slug, he can't see the 1 watt. Therefore, he goes and gets the 1 watt slug or the 5 watt slug. And because he's only measuring reverse power, he thinks he can use the 5 watt slug in the reverse mode only. He's not going to put it in the forward mode, and he's going to measure that reverse power. He is completely forgetting about the fact that that 1 watt slug or that 5 watt slug is still seeing all that excess power, and it's going into its internal termination. There's got to be a termination, a resistive termination, as part of the directional coupler in order for it to have directivity. You can't take a 5-watt slug to try to measure 1 watt of reverse power when it's 1,000 watts going forward. You can do that if you like. You're going to burn up that slug. And lots of people have done that. So even with a low standing wave ratio, you can't do that. N2XJN. KQRIW. Wait for the beep.
Repeater. Timeout.
WHYY.
Okay. N2XJN. And that's why the directional coupler made by Johnson has from one side reflected power and from the other side incident power. And that part is actually that is this device is being used with the Viking 250 meter. But I observed something when I was analyzing the schematic of the Johnson. Actually, I find out that MFJ816HF, I don't know if they had an authorization from Johnson, but they use the same principles for building their meter. Let me check for a moment. Okay, N2XJN. And the interesting concept that was used by phase compensated Bruni bridge was that actually for the circuitry they used the coaxial cable stripped and the outer coat was not welded. Was welded, kind of welded, because it doesn't look like a regular solder together by an angler. Anyhow, very easy question for you, relaxing, and I'm gonna let you rest because I was just creating so many of emotions. One of the question is, the typical old-time amplifiers, which everybody wants to use right now because they are inexpensive, they use tubes, and some of these tubes, they had a gate being grounded, and they were being driven in cathode. And then there was a regular P filter or P bridge, whichever way you want to name it. Let me chop for a moment. And that's what actually contains all of the amplifier. Very easy, very simple to do. And the P filter was capacitor, coil, and capacitor. And the question for you is, right now, how many gates has triode? And the second question is, what is the typical voltage for a typical tube to glow? Back to you.
Okay, you've asked some very good questions, and you got us quite emotionally involved in the earlier ones. I'm going to temporarily bypass your questions, Wesley. I'm going to temporarily bypass them because we've got three other people with questions. We're going to go to them, and I'm going to come back to you. I think Joe and Bill both want to ask some questions. Bill was the first one. KC2SYL, I think he wanted a clarification on what we said so far. And then Joe, W2RYY, also wants a clarification. Bill first. KC2SYL, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill. Wait for the three beeps.
This is KC2SYL. Thank you, Dick. Actually, I had a question about high-frequency antennas. I'm still trying to learn the concepts with the Yaesu 817 and to construct an antenna for it. And additionally, if you're going to open a discussion on the throttle issue with the Toyota, I have some static results I'd like to share with you. But I'd like to do the Yaesu first. Back to you.
Very fine, Bill. Looking forward to both of those. Joe, W2RYY, go right ahead with your question on this subject before we get to you. You got it, Joe.
It is on this subject. You're talking about directional couplers and stuff related to such. My question is this. You said if you take an element and read it in the reverse function to read like low power and reflective power using like extremely high forward power, and it's exposed to the high power even though it's not reading it, then how does Bird Electronic Corporation make a panel that does just that, where you have one slug reading high power and the other slug reading reflective power, which is much lower power? They're both exposed to the same power. How do you not damage the second slug, which is reading low power?
In the case of a directional coupler, mo- most of the time, the first thing that'll blow out is the termination. Once you select the coupling coefficient, which really means the parallel line, how long is it in wavelengths, how close is it to the straight-through line, that determines how much power it picks up. And if you exceed the rating of that particular slug, it's the internal termination that you're burning up. If they're smart enough to put a big enough termination in there that can take higher number of watts, then there's nothing wrong with having a very sensitive slug look at a high amount of power. You got to be careful, though. If you use that slug backwards so that the diode circuit now sees the high power, you may damage that diode. But if you've got it in the reverse mode, and you know that your standing wave ratio of your high power antenna is very low, and if that internal termination is high enough in power to take it, there's nothing wrong with using a 1-watt slug on a kilowatt system. You better have a 15-watt dummy load in there to do that. One of them makes some sense, Joe. To be 2RYY, K2RAW in the group. Wait for the three beeps.
I'm coming in via RLP. I'm the Bayshore circuit that Eric has just talked about. Yes, that's my node that's on this reflector. Okay, I'm starting to understand some of that. I have another question related to this, but I'll let you turn it over to the guy that was talking before me and put me in line with another question related to the subject.
Okay. We've kept Bill waiting for 2 hours. We ought to get to his question. So you've got an HF antenna question and an Yaesu 817 question. Go right ahead, Bill. KC2SYL. Make sure you don't go beyond 90 seconds like I keep doing. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Come back to me when you get finished. There's a couple things that you left out, like four-port devices and Wilkinson devices.
It's already complicated enough that we got heated discussion. If we start adding all those other things early in the game, Eric, oh boy, we're gonna be throwing knives at each other. You got it, Bill. KC2SYL, K2RAW.
All right, this is I'm a new ham, so take it easy, guys. And I enjoy being in a choir this evening. Basically, I have a Yaesu 817, which is a QRP rig, and I'm trying to design an antenna for it from a second-story bedroom window. And what I like to do is just take a long wire, put it out the window about 15 feet, and then get some 10 pegs that you would get at Sports Authority or a sporting goods store, and go to a front lawn, and from the 15 feet from the bedroom window to the lawn, lengthen and take another leg of that wire, probably another 13 feet, straight, and then make it an open-ended rectangle on the other side, about 10 feet, and then 13 feet on the other side. I'm just wondering what I should be aware of. I know I need a tuner, and if I take that long wire and attach it to a piece of coax, what do I do with the ground portion of the coax or the braid? Back to that.
Yeah, when it comes to NFED ZEP antennas, and that's sort of what you're discussing right now. In the case of a Zeppelin, they used to trail a wire out the back of the blimp, the Zeppelin, and as long as the piece of wire was approximately a half wavelength long or a multiple of a half wavelength long, then the wire had at its feed point an extremely high impedance, like 1500 or 2500 ohms, in which case when you're feeding an impedance that high and you got the right kind of an antenna tuner, you don't have to connect the shield anywhere. It doesn't matter. And in that case, I think they connected the shield to the metal frame of the blimp, of the Zeppelin. If you're unlucky and the wire is a odd number of quarter wavelengths long instead of a number of half wavelengths, which is another way of saying an even number of quarter wavelengths, if it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, the wire presents a very low impedance. If you don't connect the shield anywhere, you end up with a significant amount of RF energy flowing down the outside of the coax cable. That's not necessarily bad. It just means life's a little bit more complicated. You may end up with some RF in the shack. On top of that, let me drop. shot up an antenna from the second floor of a building, you've already got some nice altitude. It sure would be nice if you could string that wire out to a tree